This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
All right, we are going to be talking all spring. It's kind of loosely spring through June, I guess. On the question of the Christian community. And it's something that I feel personally, as I've been reflecting over these things for the last few weeks in preparation for coming out here on Saturday night, a growing sense of burden and conviction that there are some important things for us to really reflect on in a deep way as a church, as a fellowship. Because when you look back historically, and you can see it absolutely today in the world, as you get out there, as some of us have, I've had a chance to travel pretty widely around the world and have seen churches operating on most continents. And what I see is that when the church is at its best, it revolutionizes society. It has a terrific catalytic effect for the good, that it addresses systemic evils. It brings communities together. It heals wounds. It heals lives. And there's something dynamic and real going on in the world today through the Church of Jesus Christ. It's super exciting to know what's happening, for instance, in Asia, in sub-Saharan Africa, and in other places that are where really the whole movement of the church in the world has shifted from Western Europe and the United States really to Asia, Africa, Latin and South America. That's really where things are going on, and it is exciting to see that happen. On the other hand, too, when the church is at its worst, it just is hard to envision anything being much worse. And so you look back at the history of the church and the Crusades. There were certainly active Christians involved in the slavery movement, things like that, that are appalling and that are really just so far from the heart of God and so far from the teaching of Scripture. But somewhere between where the church is at its best and where the church is at its worst is the church as most people in our culture experience it. Several years ago, was it that long ago? It was, 1982, so a long time ago. My wife and I moved to Chicago and to do graduate work, and I'd been a Christian for about 4 years at that point. And so I knew, I need Christian fellowship. I need to get involved in a church. And we went to two or three churches in suburban Chicago. And there's this sinking feeling just kept coming over us. Is this really what's out there? Is this really what's out there? And I remember very distinctly, as though it was yesterday, on a Sunday morning, give it yet another try. We drive up to, one of the great churches in Chicago. And I looked at my wife, and she looked at me, and we decided together, we can't do this. It's just too weird. It's just not us. There's something that getting involved in this group is really to take on a social and cultural identity that I don't know that we're really prepared at this point to do. And I think that the vast majority of people in our culture are just in that place where church for them is more or less an irrelevance. That the thought of getting involved deeply in a church, well, it's just not even on the radar screen anymore. And we live, as many people have called it, in a post-Christian culture. And so what we want to talk about over these next 3 months together, as we very carefully work our way through Paul's letter to the Romans from chapter 12 through chapter 16, we want to ask ourselves this question, as Paul paints this picture of what the church is, what does it mean for us as a community of believers in Jesus Christ in America in the 21st century to really penetrate deeply into what are those principles that Paul is laying out And what do they look like to us in our own individual lives and then certainly in our corporate life together? Zenos Fellowship is a fellowship of about 125 house churches that meet all over this city. We come together for meetings like this because we want to talk about things that are strengthening and that are important, that are mutual concerns for all of us. My hope is that we will be increasingly more unified together as a family of churches here on Saturday night over these next few months as we reflect on what I think are some of the coolest, deepest truths that we'll find in the New Testament that relate directly to, you know, how do I live out my faith in this world and in this community? So I just want to urge you to think this through and pray. I just would ask you to pray for me, too, as we come back each week and get into these things that God would put the proper burdens on my heart that relate specifically to your situation. It's great stuff. Tonight, we're going to make a lot of progress. We're going to do one verse. We're going to do Romans 12, verse 1. It's kind of the thesis statement for these chapters, and so it's worth spending a little bit of time together thinking this through. We call it the heart of the Christian community. And here's what he says. He says, I urge you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. Okay, that's what we need to think about here tonight. And obviously the focus of this verse is on worship. And worship is, as the Bible describes it, really right at the heart of what we as God's people and we as, you know, the community of God's people are about. And so it's appropriate for us to think here about this issue. And we want to understand tonight, what does worship mean? And so we're going to ask, you know, the basic questions that you're supposed to ask. You know, namely, what is it? How's it done? You know, who does it? And when and where? So all the kind of basic questions. That's what we want to get at right here. Obviously, it's urgent business. Look what Paul says. I urge you, therefore, brethren, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to worship. Urgent business. This is front line, the center of what we're all about, begins with worship. What is then this idea, this thing that he calls worship? And, you know, I think that the English language term worship comes right out of the word to mean worth. And what it means is that we declare God's ultimate worthiness, that we come to a point in our minds, in our hearts, where we have agreed, we have understood, we have made a commitment, a decision to say, you know, there is one central reality that matters in my life. One integration point that defines the significance of what I'm about, what I do, all the things I'm involved in. That at the end of the day, you know, when my life's over, what I want the legacy of my life to be is that it was a life lived out to declare the worthiness of God. That's what worship means, in a nutshell. And what we find in the Old Testament and in the New is that worship is always tied to sacrifice. And this is kind of important. We want to get into this just a little bit. Old Testament worship surrounded the idea of ritual. And so in the Old Testament, there are prescriptions. It's laid out. This is what it looks like to approach God and to declare his ultimate worthiness. So you have designated people, priests, the whole tribe, one of the 12 tribes of Israel, the Levites. That was their job. Their job was to act as the priest, as kind of the intermediary between God and the people. They officiated over the rituals and the functions that are laid out in the multitude of books in the Old Testament, Leviticus. It's all about what these Levites are supposed to do, all the ceremony, what they're supposed to wear, you know, how they're supposed to present themselves. it's remarkable reading. And if you have problems with insomnia, I just urge you to pick up Leviticus and give that a read. There are prescribed places. You know, it's at the temple that you worship. And you know, not in other places. It's there, and it's in prescribed times. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and other specific holidays. These are all laid out in enormous detail in the Old Testament, because what the Old Testament is trying to teach us is some very important lessons about God. The Old Testament is teaching us that God is not like your next door neighbor. God is, well, he's, to use a Bible word, he's holy. He's completely different than you and I on a moral level. He's perfect, we're not. We can't just kind of strut into his presence because we're not acceptable. We've got a barrier between ourselves and God. A sin barrier. All of us have gone our own way, and that's created an issue between ourselves and God. And so these priests then have to come along and offer sacrifices that represent the idea that an animal who, in a kind of symbolic or ritualistic way, takes upon himself, itself, your guilt and mine, and then having, in a ritual way, conferred the guilt of the people onto the animal, then the animal is, you know, sliced open, and the blood thrown on the altar to show that the ultimate price for our sin has been paid, and then they burn that animal right up. And that is the heart of the message of the worship of the Old Testament. It's what it's there to communicate. And it foreshadows God's plan working its way out through history, that he would bring into the world his Messiah, his Son, to be the fulfillment of what these images look like. That it's not just some stupid animal that doesn't know what's happening to them, that gets sacrificed. But God himself taking on human form, taking on my sin and yours, and voluntarily sacrificing himself in atonement or in payment for your and my sin. Enabling God to look at the blood of his Son, of Christ, to say, that death is sufficient for me to then move toward you and forgive you of everything that you've done. So, with that game plan in mind and that understanding that worship is defined biblically in terms of what God's trying to accomplish in the world, we then move to the New Testament, where Jesus introduces a very important critical shift in our understanding of worship. Jesus is talking to the so-called woman at the well. And just a word of background here. This woman was not Jewish. She was half Jew. She was a Samaritan, considered to be heretics by the Jews. And in fact, they were. They had basically abandoned the heart of biblical faith to take on their own superstitions. And they merged in other kinds of paganistic worship and stuff like that. And they had built a whole culture around that. But Jesus went and he had to have a discussion with this woman. And they get into a theology debate. Well, you know, the woman says, your folks say down in Jerusalem we're supposed to worship. Our folks say it's up here in Samaria, up in the mountain, that we're supposed to worship. You know, in essence, what she's saying is, yeah, who's to say? Who's to say? Who's to say? We all have our differences. Why don't we just appreciate our differences and move along? And Jesus just goes right to that very kind of contemporary argument. And he says to her, he says, an hour is coming when neither in this place nor in Jerusalem shall you worship the Father. Rather, an hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And so now Jesus is introducing something very different than the Old Testament. It's not about times and places. You can be in Samaria, you can be in Jerusalem, and both equally be worshiping God. It's not some ritual that you perform, some external action that you do. It's something that you worship in spirit and on the basis of truth. So all these differences then begin to disintegrate in the message and the teaching of Jesus Christ. That none of this this ritual and that whole kind of approach to doing worship, none of that stuff matters anymore, because what God is interested in doing is not taking up residence in some building. He's interested in taking up residence in your heart. And so you've got a personal connection with God. You don't need to be mediated by a priest, some other person who's gone to some school and had words pronounced over him, who some comes back and then becomes a kind of magic person to stand between you and God. Jesus is saying none of that holds any longer. And so we find then, when we turn to this the description of the New Testament church, the church that was founded upon the apostles, the followers of Christ, the ones who heard Jesus utter these kind of words, that we find a fundamental lack of any kind of ritual at all. And I really like the way this Australian guy, Robert Banks, summarizes the idea of worship as it moves into the New Testament era. He says, one of the most puzzling features of Paul's understanding of ecclesia, that just means the church, for his contemporaries, whether Jews or Gentiles, must have been his failure to say that a person went to church primarily to worship. Not once in all his writings does he suggest that this is the case. Indeed, it could not be, for he held a view of worship that prevented him from doing so. Worship involves the whole of one's life, every word and action, and knows no special place or time. Since all places and all times have now become the venue for worship, Paul cannot speak of Christians assembling in church distinctively for this purpose. They are already worshiping God, acceptably or unacceptably, in whatever they're doing. And Banks is just absolutely dead on. It's exactly the way it looks in the book of Acts, which is a chronicle of the early church, in the letters that the apostles are writing to these churches. Never once is there made mention of a formal worship service. It simply did not exist in the New Testament church. Not in terms of what we look at as a worship service today. And I think that there's something important for us to consider here. Paul says, your spiritual service of worship. But you know, what it's become in our day is not a service of worship, but a worship service. That's really what the Christian community comes together and is really all about. It's that thing that happens on Sunday morning. And there are a couple things for us to consider about that. And without disparaging any of our brothers and sisters in churches all over Columbus, it's not at all my intent. But for us to think biblically about what kind of people does God want us to be, we really need to understand some things. Namely, that if we define worship in terms of an experience that people have, an event that people attend, my concern is that the Western church will risk trivializing the deep biblical meaning of what worship is, which we're going to talk about here in just a minute. If we define it just in terms of standing up and singing, perhaps, or having various kinds of spiritual experiences, and that's what worship is, I fear that we will lose the depth and the richness of the biblical teaching on what worship really means. And the second thing that we need to consider is that the preoccupation with worship, which is really what everybody in the evangelical church is talking about today, worship service, I just have to say, is bizarre. And why do I say that? Well, I say it for the same reason that George Barna does. This is in a book that he wrote recently. about getting, you know, your church to grow from the outside in, he calls it. In other words, by really reaching people who don't know Christ. And he says, he's talking about worship services, and he says, attracting, retraining, and retaining non-Christians, he says, will take more than a good worship service, since the very practice of worship is outside of their frame of comprehension and experience. Well, of course. Why would we talk to our neighbor and say, why don't you, I know that you don't know Christ. We've had these discussions. You're thinking about it. Why don't you come down and join me and my friends at this meeting where you can sing songs that you don't believe and become excited about a person that you've not met and identify with people who are not your community. And Barnum makes the point. He just says, it's obviously, you know, why would we do that? That's why we don't do that kind of thing in our big meetings where we come together, because we want people to come and hear. You know, we don't want to manipulate and experience people into Christianity. We want them to think things through and to understand what the Bible says so we can make informed decisions about where we stand with God and how. So I think that what Barna said here is just, that's right. But then he goes on in the very next sentence and he says this. They need a solid worship experience. What? On the one hand, he's saying it's manipulative and inappropriate to try to bring people, you know, to osmose Christianity into them by experience. And then on the other hand, he's saying it's really having that dynamic experience on Sunday morning that we really need to focus on. What? This is the insanity, I think, of the church in America today. It's no wonder that over 80% of the growth in evangelical churches in America today comes from people who are already involved in one church and they're going and seeking a better experience in a different church. That's a fact. Most of the rest of the growth in churches comes because people reproduce. But there's almost no real engagement with the culture around us because we have put forth this idea that what really matters is that people have the same kind of experiences that we do and that surely God will woo them to himself through that. Oh, I just think this is a huge problem. And I think where we see the church dynamically at work outside of the American experience, we don't see this weird kind of stuff going on. We see real relationships and real discussions over the Bible and engaging with one another over real matters of spiritual truth. And that's how it works. I think that's how it works largely in this fellowship as well. So I think there's a lot at stake in our ability to understand clearly what is worship. But we need to move beyond that. How does Paul describe the nature of worship? He says, present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God. That's what worship is. How do we worship? Well, by presenting our bodies, a living sacrifice. He says of your bodies, and that's just kind of shorthand for the whole of who you are. Present your total being to God. If you want to talk about worship, it's not a having an experience. Now, having experiences of God, I think, are very important and valuable. But that's not the same thing as giving over, because God is worthy, the whole of my being. And that's what Paul is calling on these brothers and sisters in Rome to do. And that's how he defines worship. And I think it's the same thing that Jesus says in Matthew 22, where he says, you know, what is it that God's really looking for? What does God want? And his answer to this is, well, you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. What does God want from you? Oh, he wants it all. And worship means giving him our all. And that's followed up then by the second commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says on these two commands depend the whole law and the prophets. The whole bag of worms or whatever the metaphor is. What does God want? All of you. All of you. And then to treat the other person as more important than yourself. Yeah, that's pretty good. What does that mean? Now, when we get out and we begin to look at the New Testament teaching on worship, while the term worship is almost never used, the terminology of sacrifice is very commonly used. And I want to just very briefly look at a couple of these areas in which a life of worship is going to work itself out. What does it look like, in other words, for me to give myself wholly and completely to God? A sacrifice of my total being. How do I do that? Well, there is first the notion of pouring out our life into the lives of others as God leads. And we're going to talk quite a bit about this idea of servant love. Not next week, but in 2 weeks, and then a couple of weeks after that as well, because this is really at the heart of what does it mean to live out our lives before God. But I really like what Paul says in Philippians 2, verses 17 and 18. He says, if I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith. You see the language there? That's Old Testament language. He's saying that just like the sacrificial animal, the heart of Old Testament ritual worship, I am being poured out for you. And he says, I rejoice. This is not some obligation, some morbid duty to deny myself. Not at all. He says, I rejoice for the opportunity to just spend myself on you and what God's trying to do in your life. And I share my joy with you all. See, he was from the South. And I urge you, rejoice in the same way and share your joy with me. Now, do you see what he's saying? To pour my life out for you is a great joy. But now you come on in. The water's nice. It's not just like Paul's some super dude. Paul understands this idea of worship. He understands that God has called him to a purpose, a task. He's got a calling on his life. But not just him. We all have been wired up by God to be able to make certain kinds of contributions to his work in the world. We're part of a body of people that depend upon our functioning, our input in their lives for them to be healthy. God placed you in your moment in time, in your place on the map. God gave you your personality. God gave you your abilities. And worship means giving those back and entrusting them to Jesus Christ so that he could fulfill the purpose that we are on this planet to in the lives of other people. It's fantastic. That's worship. We're seeing in the pages of the New Testament the idea of worship and the language of sacrifice in terms of extolling God's goodness. And so you have here, for instance, in Hebrews 13, the author's comment that through him, that is through Christ, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That is the fruit of lips that give thanks to his name. And do not neglect doing good and sharing, for with such sacrifices, God is pleased. And so what he is calling us to is to say, you know, here's another form of worship. It's when we lift up to God the sacrifice of our praise. In other words, the gift of our praise. And this is very, very important. This is not just something that you do in some kind of a large group event. It's something that you do, sometimes corporately. Yes, I think that's right. But often, throughout the day, at various points, just lifting up a thank you to God for his goodness in our lives. What does it mean? What it means is that we're believing God that there is a supernatural dimension to life. No, I'm not here alone. No, it's not all about me. No, the limits of my own abilities is not the end of the story. God is in the mix. And so the idea of our praising God and thanking God is a statement of our trust that God is in the mix in our lives. And so even though sometimes I can't see my way through the fog, at the same time, I'm prepared to take that stand, thanking God, saying that there is a supernatural orientation in my life, and I'm trusting God that you have a role in this situation, that you will work this situation out to further your cause, your purpose, in my life, and perhaps through my life, to begin to affect also your will in other people's lives. That's what it means to offer up our sacrifice of praise. It's a whole orientation of our thinking. It's the confidence that, yes, God does provide, that God does love me, that God does care and is invested in my situation. Very cool. Then, thirdly, in terms of how we worship, Peter talks about the idea of proclaiming God's grace. Look what he says here in 1 Peter 2, verse 9. He says, you, and now he's talking to a mixed bag. They're all Christians. Some are Jewish background. Some are Gentile background. But he says to them all, he says, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. He's talking here about the church, not Israel. But he's using the language of the Old Testament to say, you are now God's people. He's working through you. A people of God's own possessions. And what do you exist for? Why are you there? So that, he says, you may proclaim the excellent things of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. And so here we see the idea of worship and the whole framework that he describes here of being a group of priests, a holy nation, a people of God's possession, is so that we can explain to people how God drew us out of darkness, out of confusion, out of a whole lot of hurt, and brought us into his marvelous light, sharing the goodness of God, the truth about the goodness of God, what the Bible calls the gospel, the good news, with other people that God has brought into our lives, profoundly is an act of worship, according to this passage. Now, I think, too, that there are some other dimensions of worship as it's described in the New Testament. These, however, are the ones that are emphasized in the letters of the apostles to the New Testament church. Now, I want to go back to our verse here, because here Paul says at the end, he says, you know, presenting your whole being to God, that's what worship is. And he says it is your spiritual service of worship. And the word spiritual here, some of our translations say reasonable. And so maybe you're looking on and yours says your reasonable service of worship. And that's really much closer, the Greek word logikon is being used here. That's where we get the word logic from. Reasonable. And what Paul is saying is that the presentation of our whole being to Jesus Christ is a verdict that we reach. It's something that is reasonable, that is rational. It's a conclusion and a decision that we come to in our life. Look, if the message is true, well, what then? Now think of the implications. If I really do believe that there is a God that we can know, if I really do believe that I have come to know that God, that if I've come to believe and understand that I have an eternity in the presence of that God, that there is a message that I need to understand and a basis for standing before God that people need to know, namely the person of Jesus Christ, what he did on the cross. If I believe these things to be true, what more important thing could there possibly be to live for than that? Now, your career is pretty important, but it's not that important. Your family matters, but not that much. Look, what he's saying is there's got to be a framework that you're willing to work around. That what is the most important thing that makes sense out of all of your life? It has to be that we have just made a decision to place ourselves at the heart of what God is about and what God is trying to do in the world, because at the end of the day, that's the only thing that stands. Now, that's an impenetrable logic. I know that's true. I've taught logic for years. It's not a difficult inference. Look, if these things are true, nothing could matter in comparison to them. Nothing. Well, a lot of things tend to matter. We'll talk about that next week. But Paul is saying, look, this should be consistent in our thinking. Christianity without biblically defined worship as we've been describing it here, is irrational. Yes, I believe all these things, but I don't care. They don't make any difference in my life. That's insane. I just want to tell you, that's insane. It's unsatisfying. And you know that. And when we come to those points in our life where God is saying, okay, here's this thing that you didn't know about in your heart, in your life, in your thinking, in your values, in the way that you relate to people, and what you're about. I want you to worship. I want you to give me that. And we are saying, well, I kind of like that. And God's a real gentleman, and he's not going to snatch it out of our hands. But now, at the same time, we've got this real dilemma, this real contradiction. How I'm living my life on the one hand, and what I believe on the other. And it's just super unsatisfying. And many of us here tonight may be kind of at that place where, you know, God just doesn't seem all that real to us in our experience. Seems like a philosophical abstraction than a personal relationship. To sort of feel like I'm going through the motions in my spiritual life. You know what I'm talking about? Could it be that you've got an issue with God? Could it be that the unsatisfying nature of your spiritual experience is rooted in the fact that God's calling on you to give him some more of you, and you're having a hard time letting go? I think so. I think that's the way it is. Most of the time. Certainly been that way in my experience. Spiritually hungry people in the world around us, let's be honest, are grossed out and are left with the obvious conclusion that the Christian message isn't that important when they don't see Christians worshiping the way that the New Testament describes it. It's like joining the Lions Club or something like that. It's interesting, but so what? So what? And our lives have to answer that question, so what? See? It's very important. And so, because Paul is urging these people to present themselves, he's urging upon them a decision, a moment of decision that they need to make. Not a New Year's resolution. Not a, well, yeah, I promise God this year, you know, I'm going to, you know, do whatever I don't like to do and stop doing the things I do, or whatever New Year's resolutions are about. Not that. It's saying in our hearts, you know, instead of putting God at the stoplight, instead of maybe giving him the flashing yellow signal, let's just go ahead and move it a little further. Let's give God the green light. Let's say, God, I want you, you know, engaging in my life. I want you forming my heart. I want your way to be accomplished in me. That's really what I want to do. And that's a decision, because God's not going to force himself on you. And just like the fact that we need to make a decision to come to Jesus Christ to begin with, God's not going to force his salvation on us. Paul has to address these people, brothers and sisters, he says. Brothers and sisters, part of God's family. And he says, you have a decision to make. Are you prepared to decide, yes, I want God to have his way with the whole of my being? And that's a decision that you need to make, and that I need to make. Will I say, my life is at his disposal, I live for him? That's what this passage is calling us to. That's what worship means. And that's not just something that you do at this one point and somehow you're like on automatic pilot forever. Some kind of a spiritual, you know, and I don't think it's like that. I hope it's not like that. I've never met anyone like that. What we're talking about is a decisive battle in our hearts to say, yes, I want you to have everything. And then there are going to be for us ongoing decisions that we're going to need to make to give him our total being. Because when we tell him we want him to have our lives, we don't know what we're talking about. We don't even know what that means. Well, we have an inkling, a little piece of understanding. But then the Christian life is like this progressive revelation of what we're really all about. Yeah, it's kind of messy. And so we need to ask ourselves, what part of your total being is God seeking for you tonight? What does it mean for you to worship him, to give yourself to him? That's going to be different for different ones of us, and that's okay, because God deals with us as individuals. It's very important that we think of it in these terms. I know, for instance, in my own experience, that my life is very much like the water-saturated ground at the end of winter. Very squishy. And, you know, so there are just things that God has chosen not to take away from my makeup, which I question the wisdom of. But and somehow, you know, he sees it better. And so, you know, I find that I need to entrust myself to God, you know, at multiple points, even throughout the day, to lean against a latent mood of depression, of fatalism, of negativity. And just kind of left to myself, you know, I will become utterly engulfed by these things. And I'm not exaggerating. Really, my wife, you ask her. It is true. And so I have to lean, just as a matter of survival, against these tendencies and to entrust my own outlook and emotional life to God. And recently, what I have found is that through circumstances that have been kind of trying and difficult for me, that saturated ground has now been overcome by water, so that I feel like I'm just walking through a swamp in my emotional life a lot of the time. And I'm sure this will pass, but you know, the issue here is that until it does pass and I get the clarity that I need to get, there are still people in my life that are depending upon me not being like that. My children, my wife, the people who are close to me. And what I have learned is that, you know, what does it mean for me to worship and to give God my whole self? It means that I need to be making some decisions in the situation that I'm in to say, okay, I feel like, but But I choose in this moment to say, God, you'll resolve these things. I know you will. I'm not suppressing or ignoring them. But I must choose now, with real sincerity in my heart, to be a source of real emotional encouragement and support and love and concern for these people. And that's worship for me right now. And worship for you, mate, right now may be something like that. Maybe something radically different. Maybe worship for you at this moment in time is to take that closer look at your career ambitions and to ask yourself before the Lord, you know, is this all about me and more of my time and more of my energy? Or is this about how can I really reflect in my work life the goodness of God and to be a light and a witness to the world around me through that? Many things. But one thing for sure. There are things that God wants you to give to Him tonight. Maybe tonight's the beginning of a kind of coming to terms and awareness of some of those things or whatever. But know that there is more of you to give. There is more worship for you to perform in this life before it's over. Now, the last point briefly. Who worships and why? Brothers and sisters, that's who worship God. The people who have experience the mercies of God are the ones who are qualified to worship Him. Worship is a response to God's mercies. And over the last couple of weeks, you've had John Chris up here summarizing the argument of Romans chapters 1 through 8, which is all about the mercies of God, the great things that God has given to us. Worship is simply a response to His overwhelming mercy, His overwhelming love in our life. And so maybe for some of us here tonight who aren't really sure that we have experienced personally the mercies of God, that we've not come to that point where we've actually received the gift of forgiveness that uniquely comes through Jesus Christ and His death on the cross, that maybe tonight would be that time where we take that first act of worship and say, God, I want you to forgive me. I want you to enter into my life. I want to give myself to you in that sense. I want to stand before you when this whole thing is done on the basis of what Christ has done for me. And that's worship. And maybe that's the decision we need to start with here tonight. I'm not talking about some matter of church membership or religious experience. Those things don't make us really right with God. They may stimulate some thinking about God, but that's very different. And I know that in our culture, there are lots of people who have, perhaps in their childhood or in their teenage years, as I did, going to kind of a hippie-like commune out in Mansfield where, you know, we had this weekend and there's this guy there and he was talking about Christ. And I just was overwhelmed with the sense that, man, what this guy is saying, whatever it is, I don't get it, but whatever it is, you know, this is really true. This is real. Real spiritual experience. And you can go a lot of places and get real religious experiences. But that doesn't make you right with God. That doesn't make you a person who's experienced the mercies of God. That's different. That's when we consciously come before Him to say, these things that I've been describing, I want you in my life on the basis of the work of Christ. I need forgiveness. Will you come into my life? It's a different issue. Well, we're about out of time. But my hope is that in describing this great truth about the meaning of worship as it's described in the New Testament, that we would have a basis, a foundation then, to begin thinking together about what would it look like to be in a community of people where everyone was preparing themselves to give themselves wholly to God. Holy cow! That would be incredible. That would be dynamic. That is God's will for this church at this moment in time. I say that on the authority of this passage. And when we become like-minded, or as Paul says in Philippians 2, united in spirit and intent on one purpose, then this fellowship, like so many in the third world and in other places, has its very best days before it, not behind it. And that's where I'm excited. That's what I'm thinking about. I hope you will too. Hey, we're out of time, so why don't we go to the Lord here and just close this meeting in prayer. And if God, we do realize that you are not looking for us to present to you a bunch of religious deeds. You're not asking for us to have certain kinds of experiences, though often we welcome them and thank you for them. What you're asking us to do here tonight is to worship you, which this passage just makes it so clear that that just means presenting our total being to you. I thank you, God, that you are worthy of our total being, and that when we present ourselves to you, that you shape us and mold us and give us a kind of living that is so wonderful that we could never envision possessing that on our own. So just thank you, God, that you are personal and that you do really affect in a personal way our lives. Well, amen.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.